It's Friday, May 20th, 2011. I'm Albert Mohler, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. When President Barack Obama took office in January of 2009, he promised a new mode of engagement with the Arab world and with the larger world of the Muslims. The president went to Cairo and spoke at the American University there and set out, by his speech, several principles that he thought would lead to a new platform for the engagement of the United States with the Muslim world. Well, now we're standing in 2011. The situation is far different. It's different because of the so-called Arab Spring. It may turn out that that's too optimistic a title for what is going on in the Middle East right now, but it references the cries for freedom that have led to such political revolutions in places like Tunisia and Egypt and throughout so much of the Middle East, North Africa, and the Muslim world. But it's also spoken over against the background of the death of Osama bin Laden that brought at least partial closure to one of the deepest wounds between the United States and the Muslim world. The president spoke in the Benjamin Franklin Room of the U.S. State Department. He went back to the principles that he had first iterated in his Cairo speech, and then he said, and I quote, "Our friends in the region have not all reacted to the demands for change consistent with those principles." Now, one of the most remarkable parts of President Obama's address was how he did indeed speak to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Now, you'll recall that earlier in this week, the president announced some financial sanctions against President Assad and others in his administration. But the main thing that has been noted in the world is the fact that the president has not spoken to the Syrian leader with the same kind of intensity that he spoke, for instance, to Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. The president decided to intervene militarily in Libya, but not in Syria. Now, anyone familiar with the Middle East knows that at least a part of what's going into that is the fact that Libya is a fairly peripheral nation in terms of U.S. foreign policy, but Syria is very crucial. Now, there are estimates that at least 1,000 civilians have been killed in terms of the crackdown by the Syrian police against protesters there. And many people have been wondering when the U.S. president would speak. Well, yesterday, this is what he had to say. Quote, "President Assad now has a choice. He can lead that transition or get out of the way. The Syrian government must stop shooting demonstrators and allow peaceful protests, release political prisoners and stop unjust arrests, allow human rights monitors to have access to cities like Daraa, and start a serious dialogue to advance a democratic transition," end quote. Now, what he did not say was that President Assad must resign. And that's interesting because he has spoken with that kind of directness to others such as Muammar Gaddafi and indeed Hosni Mubarak, who was for so long a Central American ally when he was the president of Egypt. But all of this is more or less in the background in terms especially of the conversation in the United States, where the bigger issue has to do with how the president referenced the situation in terms of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. President Obama yesterday did what no recent American president has done. He called for Israel to establish a lasting peace with the Palestinians, going back to the boundaries of Israel and what would now be a new state of Palestine that were true in the eve of the June 1967 Arab-Israeli War. Now, what makes that nothing less than remarkable is that even in recent years, no president has called for anything quite so technically true to the 1967 borders as what is the American expectation of Israel. And the reason for that is very simple. It's geopolitical. Let's recall, first of all, a bit of history. In 1967, Israel did not attack the Arabs. The Arabs attacked Israel. And Israel almost ceased to exist as a nation because if you know the geographical realities of that region, Israel is exposed in virtually every conceivable direction, and its enemies were so close indeed, that when Syria controlled the Golan Heights and when so much of the West Bank was under the control of various Palestinians, the Arabs were able to launch an attack and be almost to Jerusalem before the blink of an eye. That is why Israel, and we're talking here about a nation that has a very vigorous democratic tradition and very, very loud and public political debates, but very few in Israel question why Israel has held on to so much of that territory simply because it requires a buffer. If you've ever visited the Golan Heights, you'll know immediately why Israel will be very hard-pressed to surrender that territory. It did not capture that territory by an offensive war. It captured that territory by the collapse of Arab forces that had attacked Israel with the intention of making the nation absolutely disappear. So what we're talking about here is something that is likely not to go over well in Israel. And it's not going to go over well in Israel, not just with the current administration of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, but with virtually everyone you can conceive there in Israel. And in the United States, this is going to raise some very political and interesting conversations. We're going to be, first of all, interested to hear how persons here in the United States respond to the president's statements to Israel. We're also going to hear that very quickly because Prime Minister Netanyahu is going to be in Washington, D.C. at the end of this week in order to address a joint session of the United States Congress. What he has to say is going to be very interesting, all the more interesting after what the president of the United States said on Wednesday. Now, there are other issues, of course, going on in the world, and the world continues to speak about the headlines having to do with Dominique Strauss-Kahn, who has now resigned as the managing director of the International Monetary Fund. Just in case you are not aware of what's going on with that particular case, Mr. Strauss-Kahn, who has been one of the most influential financial figures in the world and was considered to be the front runner as the socialist candidate to oppose President Nicolas Sarkozy in the upcoming presidential election in France, was arrested by New York City police and was held at Rikers Island on charges of a violent sexual attack against a chambermaid in the Sofitel Hotel in downtown Manhattan. Now, one of the fascinating things that's come out of this is, of course, the soap opera, the story of a man of incredible influence who has fallen by means of this kind of sexual scandal. He has now resigned as managing director of the International Monetary Fund. Just late yesterday, he had a hearing in which he was formally indicted for the crime, but he also was given bail, which he had not been given previously. It's a $1 million bail over against a larger $5 million bond, and it also is going to require him to be in a private apartment in New York City where he's going to be surrounded by armed guards. That's just something about how seriously the American law enforcement officials are taking this particular case. Elaine Ganley, writing in USA Today, goes to something we've discussed already, and that is how this particular scandal reveals cultural differences between, just for example, the United States and France. But she provides some data here that is even more interesting. Now, here's a distinction that many may not have noted. In France, it is illegal to show the face of the defendant and to show him with handcuffs on or shackles or in any way, to use the word that is a part of French law here, a humiliation. On the other hand, the French media have trumpeted publicly and have had no reticence to publish the name of the victim. Now, that's the exact opposite here in the United States. In the United States, our judicial system includes what is known as the perp walk, in which the media have their opportunity to film someone being brought in for arraignment, for arrest, or for indictment. And, of course, generally speaking, one of the principles of American law is the equality that means that even someone like Dominique Strauss-Kahn or any high-ranking American is brought in with his hands cuffed behind his back. The perp walk is a central part of the American judicial system. On the other hand, it is illegal here in the United States to release the name of a victim. So you have the exact opposite. We're not talking about a slight difference here. We're talking about a fundamental upheaval that separates the two cultures. There's some other interesting stuff going on here. And in terms of Strauss-Kahn, the big concern is whether or not he can rehabilitate his reputation. Now, even as there are all kinds of prognostications and predictions in the press about plea bargains and all the rest, in the United States, it would be virtually unthinkable that one could rebuild such a reputation. But in France, it might be something different. It'll be very interesting to see. One final note here gets to the egalitarianism of the American system of laws. The French have become quite adept to their elites being held to a different legal standard. It seems almost impossible to their mind that someone of the eminence of Dominique Strauss-Kahn could be humiliated in such a way. Well, to repeat what is at the last paragraph of Elaine Ganley's article in USA Today, she says this: "But there Strauss-Kahn was on French TV screens on Monday and on the front pages of French papers Tuesday, the debonair politician in his moment of ignominy. For many French, this was a man broken and delivered to his enemies on live TV." See, that's what's different. In France, they assume that this means he's being delivered to his political enemies. Whereas in the United States, given our understanding of law and order, he's being delivered over to the authorities for prosecution. A very different worldview that is reflected there. Speaking of differences, the headlines often tell you the story of how different people interpret even the same data. And there's some fascinating stuff going on right now in terms of a major report on marriage that was released by Brad Wilcox and his colleagues at the University of Virginia. It's another massive study that has to do with how Americans are marrying or unmarrying by divorce, how they are waiting for marriage. One of the biggest issues has to do with delay. As you know, Americans are delaying marriage, whereas most Americans married early in their 20s, just a matter of decades ago. Now, the average age of a first marriage for an American man is approximately 28. There's some other data in this that is very interesting, having to do with women in particular now delaying marriage, even to a greater extent than men, having to do with, of course, the fact there's some parallel data showing that women now outnumber men in baccalaureate programs in the undergraduate enrollment of American colleges and universities. But let me just read you some of the headlines from the same data. You're talking about the same study and people supposedly looking at the same results coming up with very different interpretations. And here's one. USA Today, 30% unmarried rate is the highest in six decades. The headline in the New York Times, study finds women slower to wed and divorce easing. The Washington Times headline, the same data, the words I do still ringing loud and clear in the United States. The Washington Post, number of long-lasting marriages in the U.S. has risen. Well, you're talking about the same study. You're talking about not only articles that differ in terms of the interpretation, but headlines that signal a very different meaning to the same data. Now, this is a good reminder to us that when we see this kind of study released, it all has to do with how persons are going to interpret this, because most people will never read the fine lines. They'll never get to the body of research. They'll never actually look at the report itself. So that's to say that readers in these various newspapers could come to very different conclusions about what the same study actually revealed. Now, if you're a friend of marriage, as I certainly trust that you are, you'll be encouraged to know that this demonstrates, number one, that there is a lessening of the rate of divorce in the United States. You'll be encouraged to know that there is still a heavy bias toward marriage in terms of the American population, with most Americans eventually marrying. But if you're a friend of marriage, you're also going to find plenty to concern you here, just in terms of the delay of marriage and how that is weakening the institution. And, of course, not only that, the continued rate of out-of-wedlock births that is simply now defying our moral imagination. In San Francisco, the great moral issue is now circumcision. That is to say that enough signatures have now been selected that on the November ballot, San Francisco citizens will face a ballot initiative to outlaw the circumcision of male children. Now, I know some of you are immediately thinking, well, where else but San Francisco? But this has to do with the fact that some are now trying to claim that male circumcision is a human rights violation, that it is a form of genital mutilation. By the way, there is no religious exemption. So Jewish families would be then unable to circumcise their sons in faithfulness to their own traditions and conviction. Now, the reason I bring this up is simply to say that in America, in the postmodern world, virtually anything can be politicized. Politicized is that it even ends up on the ballot box, and in this case, in a referendum, a citizen initiative. We're talking about everything being politicized, even the issue of circumcision and the decisions to be made by parents about their infant boys. The world is getting more interesting by the day. We'll report to you in November the outcome of that ballot initiative. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. This morning at 10 o'clock Eastern Time, I'll be presiding over the commencement ceremony for the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. It is a very moving event. It is incredible to see these young people graduate and be launched out into the world to fulfill their ministry and missionary service. If you would like to watch, I just want to tell you that it is streaming by video live at sbts.edu beginning at 10 o'clock Eastern Time. I'll meet you again on Monday for The Briefing.